Okay. Good morning. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Tuesday, February 14th, 2017. Happy birthday, Oregon.
That's right. Happy birthday.
As well as happy Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day.
Today we will be holding a public hearing on Senate Bill 5523, which concerns a number of health licensing boards. So I'm going to go ahead and open the hearing on Senate Bill 5523. Today we are going to have three of those boards with an interesting variety of folks coming and speaking. There's been a number of changes and people out sick and such, so we'll start with the first one and see how we do going forward. So first we're going to call up the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, and I understand Michelle Sigmund Gaines, the executive director, is not able to be here, and so Chad Dresselhaus is going to come and speak on her behalf. And also, as always, Anthony Medina from the Chief Financial Office will be giving the DAS part. And Chad, if you could introduce yourself and also your role in the organization.
First of all, good morning. Thank you, co-chairs Smith Warner and Senator Monroe and members of the committee. My name is Chad Dresselhaus. I am the Education and Compliance Program Manager with the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. Regrettably, Michelle was not able to make it today. She's ill, so I will do my best to represent our agency. So we have a little presentation to present. So this testimony is in regards to Senate Bill 5523, our budget request. We are the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board, the Oregon Death Care. Okay, mission goals and historical perspective. As a health professional regulatory board, the board shares a common mission to protect public health, safety, and welfare. It is the board's statutory responsibility to license and regulate the practice of individuals and facilities, engage in funerary services, as well as the care, preparation, processing, transportation, and final disposition of human remains. The board's programs protect public health, safety, and welfare by promoting professional behavior and enforcing compliance with civil statutes and rules established for that purpose, as well as through education and public awareness. The board began as a board of licensed embalmers in 1921 and has grown over time to include licensing for other individual practitioners in death care, as well as the inspection regulation of death care facilities. I want to highlight two additions to our program since the last time we were here and provide a brief summary of how things have been going. The first new program is the provision of accounting and budget services for all six boards within the 833 agency. As some members of the committee may recall, the legislature directed us to provide this function internally in light of the projected costs of receiving these functions via contract. This slide shows the dollar amount added to the OMCD budget in PS, personal service, and SS, services and supplies, in the middle. The other columns show the 13 to 15 actuals and estimates for external provision during the overall budgeting process. The full cost allocation represented the cost of the services and where costs were headed. The rates were being artificially held down in 15 to 17 so that the increase in the one biennium wasn't too great. Cost savings was the key driver. Under the internal provision of services, the other five boards pay their portion of expenses based on the percentage of transactional volume they use. Only the actual costs are passed on. Sharing a core service between boards is nothing new. The six boards have been collaborating or sharing costs for decades. IT is the largest example where we all share infrastructure, including servers, email, and licensing software. Additionally, most of the agencies 833 share a common office suite, conference room, printers, faxes, and other related expenses. Additionally, board members meet monthly and coordinate planning. Also, costs allocated by transaction, use, or FTE split. Of course, bringing external services into an organization isn't simple. And the services we were receiving included more than just an accountant position. It was necessary to determine who would fulfill other roles for proper separation of duties and internal controls. It hasn't been perfect. We are still making adjustments, but things are going well. One of the key unexpected benefits was the better integration of the accounting process into the day-to-day operations of the boards. Previously, while accounting services were top-notch, they were still disconnected in many ways. Bringing inside the organization has ultimately provided better visibility and integration. And of course, as I'm sure this committee in particular can relate to, learning never ends. While core accounting has been the focus, we are needing to further improve in our expertise in the state budgeting system.
Chad, if I may, I just wanted to particularly thank you for talking about what is working and what you're still having challenges on, because it's a conversation that is we have a lot around here about how do you learn things? You learn things by the things that don't go well and by learning mistakes, yet so often we're afraid to talk about the things that don't. So thank you for that very useful information about here's what's going well, here's what we're still having some challenges on. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith-Warner. And that all the thanks can go to Michelle, who helped develop this. I can try to take the credit, but that, you know.
Pass that on to her, then.
Okay. And then a policy bill transferred oversight for death filing billing as well as the indigent disposition program from the Oregon Health Authority to the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. This was done because the fee is paid by OMCB licensees, and only our licensees can apply to the fund. Aside from already having the infrastructure, authority, and relationships with licensees, OMCB was also able to add a dedicated 0.5 FTE to the program. One other side benefit is that now OMCB directly collects revenue that used to be passed through OHA, which has allowed us to control consistency in billing. The $20 death filing fee funds are now with OMCB. The two use are separate, $6 to the indigent program and $14 to the OMCB. This slide briefly lays out the implementation of this program. Most notably, it was effective as of January 2016. The bill also made a number of changes to the statute, which required all forms, processes, and communication education materials to be redesigned. This slide shows some of the data we are now able to collect. This table represents calendar year 2016 and shows claims received by ODOT region along with population and death data. So if you look at the different regions based on the claims, percentage of claims, population, it seems somewhat proportionate to the population, to the need or the request. We are probably most proud of these two charts. One of the changes to the statute was a requirement to verify veteran status for all indigent cases, even if an informant has stated otherwise. This is important because veterans make up a disproportionate amount of homeless, about 22% nationally according to the federal VA data. In these numbers for 2016, at least 5 veterans were identified only because of the change in the law and the new requirements. This represents 5 veterans who otherwise would not have received the death benefits they had earned. The second table shows one of our internal program measures. You can see the comparison of the claims filed that were complete on receipt and the effects of our improvements in license training as well as to the form itself. Being a small agency, we are able to take feedback from the users of the program and make updates or improvements quickly.
And can I ask, Chad, is that a KPM? Is there a percentage of claims complete on receipt? Is that one of your KPMs? And I know you're not the executive director, so I don't.
I can get back to you on that. Let me make a note.
This is a new program.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. On the veterans you were able to identify, were they then able to
like be buried up at Willamette rather than some other more
co-chair Smith Warner, co-chair Monroe, Representative Parrish. I believe that is correct. You know, once the licensee has contacted the appropriate to determine whether or not someone's a veteran, then they work with most likely Willamette or another appropriate place to be finally interred.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I have a question?
Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. And back to the veterans, it says, is that requiring to contact to confirm, is that an Oregon or federal law? Is that, did we pass that law or does that to contact Veterans Affairs to establish
your, Co-Chair Smith
I might have missed it in your testimony.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnett. I believe that's an Oregon statute requirement that we put in place just to ensure that those who've served our country receive the appropriate benefits.
Thank you.
As far as federal, I'm not sure if there's anything that exists as an overall requirement, but we made sure in Oregon, I guess,
that
they were honored appropriately. And now for the main course, OMCB is first and foremost a licensing and regulatory board. We license both individuals as well as facilities. We also inspect all facilities. This chart shows the type and number of licenses that we offer. And as it says on the bottom, the board also performs approximately 800 facility physical inspections, as well as document and records inspections, and investigates approximately 215 complaints each biennium. Because to explain, an inspection consists of kind of a twofold. One is a physical in the facility to make sure things are appropriate, and then a document inspection too, where the documents and contracts are randomly sampled and audited for compliance with the law.
And do you, excuse me, Chad, do you, I refer back to the pharmacy board, which does an inspection of every pharmacy every year. Do you have similar goals for your facilities? Is it to get half of them every year, all of them every year, or do you know?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe. It is a statutory requirement that we inspect all facilities within a biennium.
Within a biennium. And are you achieving that goal?
We are. I believe later in the presentation,
sure. Okay, great.
A few more slides down, it says that we are
just watching.
We are being successful.
Great.
Two more slides.
Great. Thank you.
You're anticipating the presentation?
Yes.
Our program is broken into four main areas, as noted in this table, along with some of the internal measures we use. Education is one of the most important areas. That's kind of my expertise. And really is woven into the other three as a foundation of our regulatory philosophy. While for the most part, Oregonians choose to see other health professionals, almost all of the people we interact with don't want to be detaching with a death care professional, and most don't know the law. But beyond working with the public, we believe that compliance is most effectively achieved through education. So I guess our philosophy is if you educate not only the licensees, but the public, that will avoid, in a sense, the need for compliance, because it will happen. Once people are educated, they will know the kind of the rights and wrongs of the industry. This slide shows our four legislative key performance measures, KPMs. Highlighted in the middle is the target we established when we were last before this committee, which in some cases were very ambitious. We are thrilled to report us now we are at target or above for all measures. So we are. And the big one is, you know, when we have so many licensed facilities in the state of Oregon, it is truly an accomplishment to be able to have inspected every single one of them.
And do you believe that systemically you're now set up that you will be able to continue that going forward?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, yes.
Great.
I believe we have a system in place that will help not to deviate from current success.
Great. And if I could just throw out one more idea on the investigation, since you've gotten to 100% on 6 months, you might look at whether you could shorten that goal time.
Okay.
Because if you're getting them all done now.
Quick question, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes. Representative Hernandez.
So you mentioned there was 250 usually complaints per biennium. In the 2013-2014 biennium, is that the case as well?
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, and Representative Hernandez. I don't know for sure. I mean, these are kind of an average sampling. So, so you're asking specifically for those years, was it 250 complaints?
That's correct.
I can get. Well, let me get back to you.
My intent for asking that question is, I'm assuming something happened where you had an increase in capacity to meet your goals, or what occurred within your board that allowed you to reach the goals significantly within the biennium?
I can get back to you on that if you would.
That's a great point. That clearly you were way down. You know, those were aspirational goals, yet you met them. And was that a systemic? Did you get an additional FTE? Did you change structure?
I do know that.
And again, I know you're not the ED, so right. You can get back to us on that.
I've been with this agency for about 2 years, and I can say that. And actually, I was a board member before that, so I kind of have some information as well. My understanding is there was a bit of a backlog. I don't know if it's due to staffing or whatever, but there was a backlog at a time that has now been resolved, and now, you know, current ones can be addressed. So maybe that might have to do with it, but I can check with Michelle to confirm. And also, just to kind of explain the investigation process, because I actually sit very close to the investigator when she receives calls and that type of thing. And, you know, from the time that you receive a call to the time that actually you receive documents and that type of thing, sometimes, not as an excuse or to step aside, but from the time that you receive the first call to the time you actually receive documents and can do a thorough investigation, sometimes it can take quite a while. We are mandated a certain amount of time from complaint to presentation to the board as a report, but during that time it can be quite tricky in a sense to gather everything to make an educated and a professional presentation to the board to make an educated and thoughtful decision. Okay, this is the agency organization, fairly self-explanatory. We have 11 board members and 7 support staff to support all the functions of our agency. Our revenues come from 2 sources: direct licensing fees and death filing fees, formerly called death certificate filing fee. OMCB is other funds and has revenue coming in both on an annual and monthly cycle. On the expense side, like most of our sister boards, we are comprised almost entirely of personal services, including some functions that are sourced within personal services such as much of our IT function. However, the payment of claims for indigent disposition is also budgeted here. And I guess, is everyone clear on kind of what indigent disposition is? Or?
Right, why don't you?
Okay, yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Indigent is actually a situation where there is a dead person where either no one claims the body, whether there's actually no relatives, family around, or they acquiesce from providing any further service. So the licensee, typically the funeral home, you know, determines whether, you know, goes through these statutory required steps of determining are they a veteran, contact state lands, you know, is there an estate, those types of things. So there's a quite a thorough, exhaustive process before finally identifying an individual as indigent. Also, body donation is a requirement to offer to Western University as an option. So once all those steps are, all those check boxes are checked, everything's been confirmed, then a licensee may send us a reimbursement request. And based on, and I can get you back more specifics if you like, but based on, we do a calculation based on kind of expected deaths, you know, historically, those types of things, and we set a dollar amount of what licensees will receive if they do a request through that fund. So a portion of the death filing fee goes to that program, which we now manage, which was with Oregon Health Authority prior to 2017. So I just didn't want to assume everyone knew.
That's helpful. Thank you.
We anticipate having approximately a 7-month ending balance with much of our revenue on an annual billing cycle. And with the fact that the Indigent Fund transcends biennia, we need somewhat more than the typical recommendation. Additionally, some of the board's self-insures, the ending balance helps protect against unplanned expenses such as contested case hearings, which can be quite expensive.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you for your testimony and then this off the bench. I just did other payroll. Could you please explain what other payroll expenses are to be 23% of your budget? Is that contracting out?
Is that the indigent? And if you don't know, one of the analysts might be able to tell us.
Back on your budget.
Yeah, the slide before.
Oh, I should.
Yep. That 23% of other payroll expense.
Co-chairs Smith, Warner, Monroe, Representative Wisnett. I'm not quite sure.
Chair Smith, Warner, Representative Wisnett. That the salaries and wages, the 40%. The other payroll expenses, that represents the PERS and the OPE and other benefits. So usually you'd see these two together in just a personal services group. They've split them off here. So
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, this is the first one that's close to that average of about about two-thirds of the budget goes to personal deals. And you had to add them together to get there, but most of them would have shown a 63% going to...
63%, not break it out that
way. Gotcha.
And that's where we saw it in the other ones that was already added.
Again, just for rent, can you comment on rent? Are they in Portland, the government building in Portland? And what is the square footage that they get charged for that? Do you know that rate? Interesting later if you get a chance. It's not a... Please.
Yeah, Chair Smith, Warner, Representative Wisnett. They are in the Portland State Office Building.
Yeah.
I don't know the square footage rate. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay.
Go ahead.
Finally, this morning, we have one policy bill regarding board member qualifications and term length. House Bill 2317, which I actually testified for last week, it was developed as a result of community stakeholder strategic planning. We actually have an annual strategic planning session throughout the different regions of Oregon to attract not only all kinds of stakeholders, not only licensees, those interested in the industry, but also public people and associations and those types of things. So we all annually we get together and discuss kind of issues that everyone feels need to be discussed and addressed. And this is the one that a recent issue. This bill would allow all licensee types to serve. Maintains the current size and licensee public member ratio 7-4. Currently, without this bill passing, nonprofit cemeteries, which is our largest licensee class, are not able to serve on the board. So one of the main purposes of this bill passing is that it allows nonprofit cemeteries to serve as a board member. There have been similar bills twice in the past, but it had suggested other changes. such as the change to the board size, and those failed. And currently, there are no known oppositions to this bill, either by public members or associations.
Representative Lively.
Madam Co-Chair, so the at-large members. So I assume the at-large members are selected by the board itself. And is there some criteria as far as areas of expertise or that they would want for those members to have?
Co-Chair Smith-Warren, Monroe, and Representative Lively. The governor's office actually appoints them. They fill out the interest form for any other board. I believe there is something in statute where licensees have to be in good standing and those types of things. So there's some criteria for licensees serving public members. It can be somewhat challenging to get them. So I don't know if there's much criteria as far as
their background.
Exactly. But there are some that are associated somehow with typically AARP or other kind of community associations that are a part of it.
Thank you.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, thank you for all your testimony on this thing. I think in my past service on this committee, the nonprofit and historical cemeteries, can you comment on that? And are most of the cemeteries now owned by large corporations? Could you if you know that?
Oh.
And you're welcome to get this information and send it to us as well if you don't know.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Monroe, and Representative Wisnant. I just off the top of my head, not with too much knowledge, but just kind of giving an answer until you get the answer. many of the funeral homes, I believe, are corporate owned. There are cemeteries that are corporate owned, but there are a lot of nonprofit family cemeteries out there. So I guess it just depends. It's a mixture. But if you'd like specifics as far as
but how about the historical or the family plots? I thought that's always, Madam Chair, always been an interest of your, trying to maintain those is a problem.
Well, that is an upcoming issue that actually, I believe there's a bill now that hopes to address kind of abandoned cemeteries. That is a concern, I think, throughout the U.S., where managers, sextons of cemeteries are getting older. The younger generations don't seem as interested in keeping and the upkeep. When there are community programs such as the Boy Scouts or local community organizations that clean, that's great, but sometimes those aren't available. So those are things that we're discussing, and I don't know if there's an immediate answer to how do you address that. There is an Oregon historical run by Curry Gill. She is the executive director of that. So through the Parks and Recreation. So they deal with historic cemeteries and often some are family.
If you could maybe get us some information on that would be great. Senator Roblin?
Yeah, follow up on that same question, just because there are two schools that they are on their campuses. So the University of Oregon, as we know, has a cemetery, and Marshfield High School in Coos Bay, which I was the principal, we have one that's owned by the city and actually is used from time, but it's a pioneer cemetery, same thing you're talking about. And it's been, it was really in disrepair. Then we had a student that took it on and has cleaned it all up. And actually the federal government, if they are veterans, they will replace headstones. So we have, almost all of those have been replaced at our school one. We had a vandalism last week where they stole a headstone. And we've had that problem in the past, so it continues to be something you have to watch all the time. So we've got a better fence around it now and other kind of stuff. And it happened, it was a historic one. It was two young children. There's a couple issues in the cemetery you can show when epidemics went through. And they happened to be the grandchildren of the first territorial governor, Mr. Lane. And their headstone was stolen. So we're still no evidence. We haven't figured out who yet, but we're still working on that because it's an important part of what our kids do now to try to maintain that cemetery, which is, okay. It did take a long time to get kids actually interested in understanding and dealing with it. So,
thank you.
I guess one other thing just kind of came to mind, I guess in a sense to promote. I know the Oregon Historic Historic Cemetery, they offer grants every year. So I don't know if you have abandoned cemeteries or kind of cemeteries in disrepair in your districts, you may, you know, that may be an option. That
more information that you can share.
Yeah, and I can provide
And, also, we do have two more boards to get through today. So,
but just, that just came to mind that there are limited resources for historic abandoned cemeteries in a sense where projects can be supported.
Okay.
So thank you for your time and allowing me to testify.
Thank you. And then Anthony, do you want to go ahead?
Cemeteries are a dark subject.
Okay. Almost got to read some of your notes there.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. Today I'll be going over the Governor's recommended budget for the Mortuary and Cemetery Board. One emerging issue for the practice of mortuary cemetery or in the field is the cremation rate. Nationwide has been raising steadily, and over the, especially in the state of Oregon over the last decade, currently Oregon ranks third in the country. For the cremation rate. The governor's budget maintains current services and supports the following adjustments to the shared account two apportionment. This is expenditure history for the agency. The governor's budget is essentially supporting 1517 LAB.
That
Senator
appears,
Roland?
Thank you. That appears to be the reason for the improvement in the, if you look at the dates and the timeline, they improved by
1.25 almost FTE.
Here's the expenditure category. In a pie chart, and I believe Senator Roblin would appreciate the near
66%. Yeah, it's very close.
Near two-thirds breakdown. And the governor's budget again supports current services, minor adjustments, and updates the DAS price list and state government service charges.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you.
Well, Chad, thank you so much for your testimony. We appreciate it, and I know we'll all look forward to some of that information about historical cemeteries and some of those other questions. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Next, we have the Board of Speech-Language Pathology and Audiology, and Aaron Haig. Long A, those two A's.
Even though it really director. Should be Hawk, but we won't go on.
We won't quibble.
Thank you. Co-Chair Smith-Warner and Co-Chair Monroe. My name's Aaron Haig, and I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Examiners for Speech-Language Pathology and Audiology. I also seem to have caught this bug that's going around our suite, so we're having fun today. I wanted to tell you a little bit. That's the South San Am River near Lebanon, where I grew up. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the profession today and its impact here in Oregon, especially with preschool children, but really throughout the school system as well as in the healthcare environment. So speech, language, and communication disorders is the biggest health issue that children are dealing with across the country. And according to the 2005 proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, it affects at least 7% of the children. That's the cutoff point where services are desperately needed. A lot of the kids need help all the way up to about the 15th percentile. So it's about 16,000 children age 0 to 5 here in Oregon. And then according to Oregon's early hearing detection and intervention program, where they test babies within just a couple of months of their birth, hearing is the most common birth defect. So the audiologists and the SLPs have kind of a big population of little kiddos that need their services. And so early identification and treatment of these issues is critical to success in school and in life. And according to the Florida State First Words Project, for every $1 invested in early education, you're saving $7 later in remedial education past the age of five, as well as welfare and crime control. So a lot of our prisoners just never did get the help they needed when they were little kids, between the age of three and five, when their brains are still developing. So also these professionals are, of course, dealing with older children and high school kids and what have you, but they also are dealing with, in healthcare situations, with victims of stroke, accidents. They do swallowing studies to help work with the dietitians at post-stroke. They also assist individuals who are on ventilators who need speaking valves, and then audiologists. And so the SLPs have master's degrees. The audiologists have doctorates, and they specialize in identifying, diagnosing, treating, and monitoring disorders of the auditory and vestibular system portions of the ear. They are trained to diagnose, manage, and treat hearing tinnitus and balance problems. Tinnitus or tinnitus is actually a symptom of an underlying health issue. So it's not strictly a hearing issue. And so a lot of times it's really a symptom of a brain tumor or very serious things, and that's why audiologists who have their doctorate need to be involved in this. The board itself was established in 1973 to regulate the performance of speech-language pathologists and audiologists for consumer protection. We have two public members on our board, as well as two audiologists, two SLPs, and one ENT physician, otolaryngologist, if I can say that. And we try to have a balanced board in terms of all types of diversity, but especially diversity of our state of Oregon here. We need to make sure that we're working with rural areas as well as the more urban areas. There's definitely been a shortage of SLPs in the school systems and the rural areas, and even in the inner city. And it's a challenge. So we want to have a nice balanced board. And then the questions come up in other presentations. So our board members receive just the $30 plus reimbursement for out-of-pocket costs. Accomplishments during this biennium, we did implement the FBI background checks. We were one of the last boards to do that. I actually started exactly 2 years ago today. Pretty much my first day was coming to visit you.
I'm sorry.
It's fun. And so, anyway, we did implement that, and we did do a renewal. We did the LEDS check on the renewals, which we do every other year. Then we also implemented the universal licensure program. There used to be an exemption in our law which allowed the folks with a teacher's license and the endorsement and communication disorders to excuse me, to work in the schools. And the last legislative session, that bill passed, which removed the exemption. However, it did grandfather everybody who's currently licensed with TSPC so that they can continue to work as long as they keep their license current. And we've seen a few folks come over to our license. It hasn't been, you know, a herd of people coming over, because a lot of these folks never did get their master's, and now it requires a master's to have our license. But we're glad that they are able to keep working in the school districts. We also are happy to say that as a small agency with just myself and a full-time assistant, David Lynn did get us onto the new look and feel website. by studying the modules and working with DAS on that. And so we're happy to have that rolled out. And then we're also a part of the transition to the shared in-house accountant. And I wanted to thank DAS, give a shout out to them, as well as the medical board, which our accountant and myself have gone over there and for some trainings and obtained their internal procedures and things like this to kind of help us along. Emerging issues. The physical therapy board came to you last February to the legislature, and it was passed the national compact licensure. So I believe they now have the 10 states that they need to be able to now form the national organization that's going to be doing that. So on a national basis, the speech language pathologists and audiologists are also looking to that as a possibility. So ASHA, their professional association, and then the NCSB, which is the group of boards across the country, like our board, and we meet annually. And so they have formed a committee, and we'll be looking into possibly doing that here with our professions. The other big emerging issue is telepractice. People are doing it. We have, people, and they have to have our license and then the license in their own state. We do have people calling in, through Skype from New Jersey, working with kids in various areas of the state. So the only thing that we have on the books right now is you can't do treatment solely by correspondence, which is very old way of looking at things. So we really need to update what we're doing with telepractice.
Thank you. Representative Parrish?
On the telepractice, and you talk about licensure, and they have to be licensed in our state, what's the bar compared to other states? And then also, I can't remember if you were in 11 or 12, when we did all of the kind of the veterans reciprocity. We just said if you have, if you were a veteran or spouse and you were practicing somewhere else, that we were going to, do sort of a fast path reciprocity. And we did like a lot of licenses, but I don't remember if we did yours.
Co-chair Monroe and Smith Warner, Representative Parrish, I don't believe you did do our board. So we will look into that, and we're willing to be come on board with those kinds of efforts. And as far as the standard across the country, I feel pretty good now, having gone twice now to the National Council of Boards, that we're all pretty equal in terms of our standards. Yes, we want Oregon to have its own and verify everybody's license, everybody's source documents and all of that. But basically, all of these professionals want to get their certificate of clinical competency, their C's, and that's their professional certification. And because of that, our laws are sort of based on ASHA's C's. We rely on them to tell us which universities are accredited, and we, use that list in our statutes and rules. And they don't have to become a member of their professional association to get a license with us, however, but most want to. And so that's where the standard is on a national level. So I think we're all fairly equal. Maybe perhaps with the speech language pathology assistants, we all are different because ASHA has not yet wrestled that one down and come up with some national standards. So each state is different. So for instance, in Oregon, you have to have been an SLP for 2 years as a professional before you can supervise an SLPA. The caseload belongs to the SLP, and sometimes that gets confused and people want to try to save money and use an SLPA. But no, they're assisting the SLP who has that master's degree and that expertise to work with that kid. Whereas in California, you don't have to have 2 years. I believe it's one, or you just have to have your C's or your license. So that's one question that's come up. One organization wants to know if they're based in Oregon and they have telepractice workers working in California, whose standards do they need to meet? Because we also have ethical standards and reporting requirements and things like this. So it's definitely time for us to tackle telepractice. OT and PT did it in the past. The medical board did it a long time ago, and it's a timely thing for us to
follow. Is that good? Okay, go ahead.
we also may be looking at audiology assistants because their folks are being used more and more, and so we kind of need to, again, come up with some standards for that at some point in time. And then, again, looking at better systems for supervision of the SLPAs, that's something that OSHA, the professional group here in Oregon, is taking on as a work group, and they're going to be working on that in coordination with us. And then we do still have some of the school districts not understanding what an SLPA is, not even understanding the difference between the C's and our license, which is kind of frustrating because you have to have a license to work in the state of Oregon. And then our major budget drivers, we do have our licensees keep going up. The numbers are going up. Last biennium, it was 14.3%. It's already 14.9% this biennium. And that's good because we need that. Portland State doubled its program, which is great. And then Pacific has added a program. And then there's also the University of Oregon. So we're pumping out more graduates now, which is helping with the shortage that we've had over the years. We do have increasing number of out-of-state providers obtaining our license and working in Oregon. And again, that's one reason we feel we need to have the telepractice rules. We do rely on their professional expertise, but about perhaps as many as 15% of little kids are not appropriate for telepractice. And unless you are on the ground doing an evaluation with them in person, how are you going to really know that? So that's one area we think it might be important that the initial eval be done in person by, if it's not that speech pathologist in New York, at least an Oregon, somebody here in the state. But that's just one of the issues. And then our caseload averages have been, you know, variable, but we did go up from 39 in 2015 to we had 63 last calendar year. And the addition of the fingerprint background check program actually only gave us about five new cases. And that was part of what we thought that we needed a part-time investigator. And when I sat before you 2 years ago, before I really knew. So I did not actually hire that position yet because I was attempting to save money and to figure out if we really needed it. And also my position and the assistant position are now full time. So we've, with contracted service, been able to handle that. And so probably because these folks have to go through their background checks to get into their master's and doctoral programs, they're sort of pre-vetted. And there were only two people who didn't report on that on our last renewal that we had to open investigations on. And we have complicated cases. They're everything from IEPs and the IDEAL law all the way to speaking valves and, you know, professional competence around the more advanced kinds of medical things that these folks are dealing with.
Senator Roblin?
Thank you. So has your use of the judicial system grown at the same rate? So are you getting more expenses from the Attorney General?
Yes, co-chairs Smith Warner Monroe and Senator Roblin. Yes, we have. We do have a case right now. We're waiting for the answer. It's gone all the way to judicial review. This particular individual now owes us $50,000 in legal fees. She's moved out of the state. She's in any event, she decided she's going to take it all the way, and she did. And although she decided not to have her lawyer make the presentation, so they just went based on the briefs, and we're hoping to hear at any point. So that's always a risk. And all of us in the 833 group, and I think all of your folks running the professional licensing boards, we all write our own orders. We do our negotiating with these individuals, and unless they obtain counsel, and then we have to pass them off to our counsel. But we do all we can to try to save those fees. And we're on the flat fee system, which okay. is helpful. So that kind of, you know, the three-year rolling average. And so my 50 grand is in that 3 years.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's going to go down now. But you never know when another complicated case right. is going to come up. So
thanks.
So like I said, we're both full-time positions now, so we're able to do a little bit of the investigating and kind of some of the behind-the-scenes things, but really we need the interviews and most of the interaction in the investigation to be done by an investigator. And that's why we have a contracted, a minority-owned firm, George Finch Investigating Services. He works with Chiropractic Board and ODE and some other boards, so he's very valuable to us. And it's good to have that separation between the director and the actual investigation. So we don't expect, we're not going to have a fee increase this time around, and I doubt we'll need it next go around either, because of if the license keep going up by 14-15% every biennium, then we won't need to be raising them. We could even consider lowering them in the future, but I think we need to have a little more data before we look at that.
Senator Roblin?
So we've passed laws to allow people to extend their licenses, especially in schools, because we didn't have enough people. Are we getting closer to a system where we may not have to do that? I know most of those are in rural areas where we have extended the life of some of these people so that they can continue to practice because we don't have people out in the rural areas. Do we anticipate with this continued increase that there will be enough eventually that we won't have to have the special certificates for these retired people?
Co-chairs Monroe and Smith Warner and Senator Roblin. I think at some point in time we will meet it. And if you add telepractice to the mix, there are these companies that run these telepractice groups, and we're finding that more and more. We're getting these out-of-state folks being licensed with us. So, again, that's why we think we need to have some more parameters and rules around that, just to make sure the kids are getting, you know, the service that they would be getting if it was in person. But, yeah, I think with the additional graduates and what have you, that we may get to that point.
That would be good.
Thank you. And to be clear, you believe that you can manage the capacity despite the increase, because it's great that an increase keeps your costs even as long as your staff capacity continues to be able to manage that.
Right, Senators, Co-Chair Smith Warner. I've heard kind of a rule of thumb that if you have 200 cases a year, that really justifies a full-time investigator for these kinds of boards. And so, you know, that's why we had the part-time position. I think we will have to keep an eye on that.
Great.
Because we do have an increased volume. We do have to contract with clinical experts, audiologists, and SLPs to look at patient charts and, drill down into some of these things that us lay people really don't get. It's very helpful to have them as well.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead.
So that's the end of mine.
Okay, great. Thank you. Go ahead, Anthony.
Co-Chair Smith-Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. And today I'll be going over the Governor's recommended budget for the Board of Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology. The mission of the board is to protect the public by licensing and regulating the performance of speech-language pathologists, speech-language pathologist assistants, and audiologists. The governor's recommended budget maintains existing services and includes a technical adjustment. Essentially, the governor's budget supports the 1517 LAB. Here's their expenditures broken down by category. For this agency, personal services accounts for roughly 3/4 of the agency's expenditures. Is there revenue history for the agency? The governor's budget supports current services and makes the following adjustments. OHA now, they are part of the OHA workforce database, so the governor's budget transfers out the fees that OHA collects for their workforce database, and adjustments to accountant to apportionment, and then adjustments to DAS price list and state government service charges.
Okay. Any other questions? I think the only other question that I have maybe is if you could get back to us with some information about the number of licensees in each of your categories.
Oh, okay. I will provide that.
Great.
Absolutely. It's in the big book here, but we right now have 27, 69 as of today.
Okay.
So
thanks. Anybody else? Great. Okay, thank you so much. Okay, we are going to go ahead with our final presentation from the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. I understand we may have two people, or we have the outgoing executive director as well as the incoming executive director. I'm not sure if they're both here. And I would also like to point out that I believe our next testifier provided some cookies for the state's birthday that are in the back. If anybody needs help getting through the rest of the committee, that's right. Please go ahead. Senator Thompson, go ahead. So Ann Walsh is the outgoing executive director, and Mary Beth Baptista is the incoming. And however you'd like to start, okay. We'll try to hold ourselves in, but we will go over to tomorrow if necessary.
Okay. Chair Smith-Warner and Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, I am Ann Walsh. I'm the outgoing executive director. Mary Beth Baptista was hired effective yesterday. So she, unless you have questions for her that she can answer, you may want to wait till next session. And
She should talk to Aaron about coming and presenting on the first day of her job.
It will be her anniversary.
It's nice because the House changed their people, and except for Smith Warner, and they were really hard on her last year. So the Senate has always been kind. But.
Well, we appreciate your attention. Naturopathic physicians have been licensed in the state of Oregon since 1927. They are healthcare practitioners who have the same number of years of medical education as a allopathic physician. Their first 2 years are very, very similar. It's all the anatomy, the chemistry, all of the basics of the human body. The last 2 years is where the philosophy changes a bit in how symptoms are treated, as opposed to they research what has caused it while they're maintaining the care of it, so that the person learns how to take care of themselves better, to heal themselves a little bit on a different level. And our chapters are 685, and our rules are 850. And the rules are constantly looked at to update to make sure that we're staying current with our statutes. We have two bills for amending our statute. As of yesterday's board meeting, we're withdrawing one of those bills because there were some complications some confusion in the language that was proposed by the board and what the professional association wanted. So we felt we should sit down and talk with them a little bit more before submitting it for change. So it'll probably wait till the 2019 session. The board's mission is the protection of Oregonians in assuring the higher care of naturopathic medicine by licensing and regulating the profession. The board is composed of 7 members. It has 5 ND members and 2 public members. It's got a full composition as of December. I believe we have a full composition. We have 3 ND members out of the area. One is from Bend, so Central Oregon is represented. We have one from Medford, so we have the Southern Oregon perspective, and we have our newest member who came in December is from Astoria, so we have some of the coast. It's really nice to have that diversity in the geography of the state for decision making and understanding the practice. The other members are local. The composition of the board should remain pretty consistent for the next 3 to 5 years, which will be nice with the transition of both our new director and we've just transitioned into a new attorney general representing our agency, just their workload situations. Board members are compensated for their attendance at board meetings as well as reimbursed for their travel and overnight stays. The number of licensees in Oregon continues to grow. It has slowed down somewhat in the last couple of years just because there are more states. Every year, new states are requiring licensure. So those people who maintained a license in Oregon for their credibility in their unlicensed states now are opting to just maintain a license in their state. And so they either go to an inactive status with us or they just let their license expire. I am happy to say that just because it means that there's more states that understand the importance of the public protection in healthcare. As of 2008, all of our new applicants are required to have a criminal, the state police FBI background check done. So that's been in effect since 2008. Really nothing. It's been a good thing because it kind of holds the doctor responsible for where they're at, where they've come from, and where they're at. And we do, we just finished our 2016 renewal cycle. It ends December 31st. And in January and February, probably March now, we will start doing a LEDS check on all renewals, which is just a state check to make sure that there aren't issues that somebody inadvertently forgot to disclose before they renewed. And that will be, those background checks, if further investigation is needed, it will need to be done by an investigator. That is why we have one policy package. It's policy package 110, requesting that our half-time investigator become a full-time investigator. I just handed some little tables that I created over the last 7 or 10 years showing how many complaints we get in a year, and we are not meeting our KPMs on that because we were meeting them at 8 months and we were hoping for 6 months, but in the last year and a half our caseload has increased. They're much more complicated, and with only a half-time investigator, they just aren't getting looked at in this timely manner. And then those that are more complicated require more time. So the priority ones are the ones where there's more concern about public safety, and they take the time. So I don't have the updated chart in the book, but for 2016, I think our goal was 6 months, but we're closer to 12 months right now, just because there's 15 open cases, and of those there's two that have currently contested, which will be going to hearing in the next month or so, and that just takes so much time. So to have a full-time investigator is just kind of imperative for.
And looking at this chart you gave, it looks like the director used to play a role in the investigating as well.
I did. So when I've been with the board since 98. So from 98 to 2001, I think I worked with one of the board members, and we did the investigations ourselves. As they became more complicated, we needed somebody who had probably better investigative skills. I took the trainings but could focus on it more. And so I went with contract employees because mm-hmm. it just wasn't a workload to require staff, and then after that realized that you really need to have somebody in office who's in touch with the profession, who can focus on who has the focus to take care of it. And so have had temporary employees who worked for as long as I could hold them, and finally have, as of December 2016, had a temporary employee who finally conceded to be our permanent employee, and she's ready to be full-time if possible.
Thank you.
So we appreciate that help if we can get that.
Okay.
Let's see. We are, for our investigations and our legal counsel support, we have been on the flat rate since 2011. And prior to that, I had to go to the e-board twice because we had major cases that were contested and we had no AG funds left. So we had the cash reserve, we just didn't have it the limitation. So to be on the flat rate has taken that load, that weight off the board in their decision making on, you know, how you proceed with a complaint. They're more practical, or you know, you don't have that financial burden of how are you going to proceed. Part of the way the profession deals with complaints is when a complaint comes in. When I first started, there were only 200 licensees, so there's closer to 1,400 now. Everybody knew everybody. So what we had to start doing in 2000 or 2001 was redacting the name of the practitioner from the complaint when it came in, so that the board would look at the complaint on the merits of the case, as opposed to having any chance of bias of knowing who the practitioner was. And it really has made a huge difference in how they look at cases. So I think it was good. Anyway, I just want to thank you for your time, and truly hope that we can get what we need to continue going.
Questions? Well, thank you so much for your service. That is, let me tell you, that's an astounding tenure for a board ED. So thank you. And you must have really overseen a lot of changes and developments, if there were only 200 when you started and there's 1,400 now.
Yes.
So thank you for your long and ongoing service to the naturopathic physicians and also to the state.
It was my pleasure, and I think I'm going to miss it a little bit, but I'll find something to stay busy with.
Great. And Mary Beth, do you want to say anything? You don't have to, but before we go to Anthony for the numbers, would you like to say anything?
I'm just excited to... been a career public servant, and I'm excited to work for the state of Oregon and be the director, and look forward to working with you all.
Great. Thank you. Okay. And Mr. Medina.
Musical chairs.
Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. And today I will be going over the governor's recommended budget for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. The mission of the board is to protect the public by licensing and regulating naturopathic physicians. An emerging issue for the agency is their investigative workload. And Anne alluded to earlier, the governor's budget maintains existing services, includes a technical adjustment, and adds limited resources to the agency. Here's our expenditure history. As you can see, for the governor's recommended budget, we approved the agency's increase from the investigator from half-time to full-time. Here's our expenditures by category. And their revenue history. The governor's budget supports current services and makes investment in makes the following adjustments. It increases the investigator 2 position, transfers out the OHA workforce database, and adjustments to the shared account 2 apportionment, as well as adjustments to the DAS price list and state government service charges.
Great. Is that it?
With that concludes my presentation. I could answer any questions you might have.
Senators, representatives? Okay. Thank you very much, Anthony.
Thank you.
And thank you again.
Thank you.
No one has signed up for public testimony on this bill so far. Is there anyone here who didn't sign up but is still interested in testifying? Okay. With that, do I need to hold this over as well because we're doing it tomorrow?
You need to hold over the informational.
Right, and the informational. Meeting. Okay. Yeah. On the informational meeting, rather than have Doug see how many words he can say in 3 minutes, we are going to hold that over and hold over the hearing on Senate Bill 5523 to tomorrow, when we will continue that. And if there's no other business, then we will adjourn. Business.